Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook paper and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives, particularly one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It helps us to analyze and improve our own financial security, personally and nationally, and to deeply understand the cause of the problems we are personally experiencing financially. At the onset, I give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles on debt-related matters. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt. You should also visit her website by the same name. You could also go to www.kruufm.com under Archives to listen to all of the shows produced on this and other debt-related topics. This particular series is under Life and Debt Web. We ended the last show talking about derivatives. Many crises that we see and have seen recently are actually linked to the teetering derivatives pyramid. Market analyst Jim Sinclair called it the crime of all time in reference to the derivative scam itself. He wrote, quote, "Default swaps and derivatives were always a scam if you consider their inability to do what they had contracted to do. All that existed was world-class, unbridled greed. The entire financial world is now threatened with a problem for which there is no practical solution: unwinding derivatives that are hell-bent on producing a financial apocalypse." Close quote. That the derivatives scam was indeed mainly about greed was confirmed by investment guru and trading insider Jim Cramer in a televised episode in 2008. Mike Whitney, who transcribed the segment, wrote, quote, "In Cramer's last explosion, he details his own involvement in creating and selling structured products, which had never been stress-tested in a slumping market. No one knew how badly they would perform. Cramer admits that the motivation behind peddling this junk to gullible investors was simply greed. Here's his statement, quote, "It's all about the commission. We used to say, the commissions on structured products are so huge, let's jam it." It's all about the commish. The commission on structured product is gigantic. I could make a fortune jamming that crummy paper, but I had a degree of conscience. What a shocker. We used to regulate people, but they decided during the Reagan Revolution that that was bad. So we don't regulate anyone anymore. But listen, the commission in structured product is so gigantic. First of all, the customer has no idea what the product really is because it is invented. Second, you assume the customer is really stupid, like we used to say about the German bankers. The German banks are just bozos, throw them anything. Or the Australians, morons. Or the Florida Fund, ha ha. They're so stupid, let's give them triple B, which is junk grade. Then we just laugh and laugh at the customers and jam them with the commission. Remember, this is about commissions, about how much money you can make by jamming stupid customers. I've seen it all my life. You jam stupid customers. End quote. Greed has been fostered not only by the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, but by the corporate structure itself. Traders and management can hide behind the corporate shield, walking away with huge bonuses and commissions while the company is dissolved in bankruptcy. Angelo Mozzillo, the CEO of Countrywide, was expected to leave the corporation with about $50 million after virtually bankrupting the company and a horde of borrowers and investors along with it. Being at the head of the subprime mortgage bubble, however, it turns out that Mozzillo turned his back on $37.5 million in severance pays and perks, as well as a $400,000 annual salary, and instead opted to testify on the whole mess before the Congressional Committee on Oversight and Government Reform in March of 2008. After the housing loan episode, Countrywide Financial agreed to be bought by Bank of America to the tune of $4.1 billion. Mozzillo's bare-bones retirement package, which he received for his years with the company, totaled only about $23.8 million. So we see the current unregulated environment parallels the abuses of the 1920s. Journalist Robert Kuttner testified before the House Committee on Financial Services in 2007. He said, quote, "Since repeal of Glass-Steagall in 1999, after more than a decade of de facto inroads, superbanks have been able to reenact the same kinds of structural conflicts of interest that were endemic in the 1920s, lending to speculators, packaging and securitizing credits, and then selling them off, wholesale or retail, and extracting fees at every step along the way." And much of this paper is even more opaque to bank examiners than its counterparts were in the 1920s. In fact, much of it isn't paper at all, and the whole process is supercharged by computers and automated formulas. End quote. Unlike in the 1920s, the financial system is now precariously perched atop hundreds of trillions of dollars in derivative dominoes, which will come crashing down when the gamblers try to cash in their bets. The betting game that was supposed to balance and stabilize markets has wound up destabilizing them because most players have bet the same way on a continually rising market. Kuttner said, quote, "An independent source of instability is that while these credit derivatives are said to increase liquidity and serve as shock absorbers, in fact, their bets are often in the same direction, assuming perpetually rising asset prices. So, in a credit crisis, they can act as net destabilizers." Close quote. The lenders were gambling that they could avoid liability by selling risky loans to investors, and the bond insurers were gambling that they would never have to pay out on claims. And that was another of Cramer's rants. Unlike car insurers or home insurers, the all-important bond insurers did not have the money to pay up on potential claims. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Going back to 2008, while media attention was focused on the French rogue trader incident, what really drove the market's plunge then was the downgrade by one rating agency, Fitch, of one of the monoline insurers, AMBAC, and the threatened downgrade of another, MBIA. The monolines are in the business of selling protection against bond default, lending their AAA ratings to otherwise risky ventures. They are called monolines because regulators allow them to serve only one industry, the bond industry. That means they cannot jeopardize your fire insurance or your health insurance, only the money you or your pension fund invests in safe AAA bonds. The monolines insure against default by selling credit default swaps. Basically, they insure by taking bets. Credit default swaps enable buyers and sellers to place bets on the likelihood that loans will go into default. The insurers serve as the risk counterparties, but they don't actually have to ante up in order to play. They just sit back and collect the premiums for taking the risk that some unlikely event will occur. The theory is that this spreads the risk by shifting it to those most able to pay, the insurers that collect many premiums and have to pay out on only a few claims. The theory works when the event insured against actually is unlikely. It works with fire insurance because most insurers don't experience fires. It also works with municipal bonds, which almost never default. But the monolines made the mistake of insuring corporate bonds backed by subprime mortgages. The catastrophe insured against was a collapse in the housing market, and when it occurred everywhere at once. Investments everywhere were going up in flames, spreading risk like a computer virus around the world. According to a 2005 article in Fortune magazine, MBIA claimed to have no loss underwriting. That meant it never expected or intended to have to pay out on claims. It took only safe bets. In 2002, MBIA was leveraged 139-1. It had $764 billion in outstanding guarantees and a mere $5.5 billion in equity. So, how did it get its AAA rating? The rating agency said they based their assessments on past performance, and during the boom years, there actually were very few claims. That, however, was before the housing bubble burst. Today, MBIA is being called the Enron of the insurance business. Of course, like with the public demand for transparency and it eventually happening, by 2010, Moody's referred to MBIA's rating as B3, which frankly is a speculative grade category. Obviously, transparency is a very important key in this entire game. Just like in The Wizard of Oz, being able to look behind the curtain changes the whole response by the general public. The downgrade of AMBAC in 2008 was merely from a AAA to a AA, not something that would seem to be market-rocking significance. But a loss of AMBAC's AAA rating signaled a simultaneous downgrade in the bonds it insured, bonds for over 100,000 municipalities and institutions totaling more than $500 billion. Since many institutional investors have a fiduciary duty to invest in only the safest AAA bonds, downgraded bonds are dumped on the market, jeopardizing the banks that are still holding billions of dollars worth of these bonds. The institutional investors that had formerly bought mortgage-backed bonds stopped buying them in 2007 when the housing market slumped, But the big investment houses that were selling them, including Citigroup and Merrill Lynch, had billions worth left on their books. If MBIA, an even larger insurer than Ambac, were to lose its AAA rating, severe losses could result to the banks. Well, even though, as I said, MBIA lost its rating, there were other things to do. What to do? Well, the men behind the curtain came up with another bailout scheme. They would create the appearance of safety by propping the insurers up with a pool of money being collected from the banks. The plan was for 8 Wall Street banks to provide $15 billion to the insurers, something the banks would supposedly be willing to do to preserve the ratings of their own securities. The insured would be underwriting their insurers. The image evoked was of two drowning men trying to save each other. Even if it worked in the short term, it would only buy time. The default iceberg was only beginning to emerge. According to an article in the UK, Times Online, saving the insurers could actually cost $200 billion. It was an ante that could bankrupt the banks, even if they were to agree to it, which was unlikely, particularly when at least one of the banking giants, Goldman Sachs, actually had an interest in seeing the insurers go down. While on one side of its Chinese wall, Goldman was devising and selling mortgage-backed securities, on the other side, it was selling the same market short. Goldman was credited with unusual prescience in this play, but the other banks possessed the same information. Goldman was distinguished only in having the brazen temerity to bet against its own faulty derivative products. With the repeal of Glass-Steagall, creditor banks can bet against their own debtors by using short sales, putting them in a position to profit more if the debtors go down than by trying to save them. Rather than becoming a partner, the parasite has become a predator. The parasite no longer has to keep its host alive, but can actually profit from its demise. So what we have seen is that Congress and the Fed have unleashed an era of greed. Of course, the courts are still there to referee. Among the daunting challenges facing the banks today is when the curtain is lifted on their derivative schemes, the defrauded investors will turn around and sue. If history has any lesson, however, it may be that the insider knowledge and manipulations behind the curtain may either postpone the curtain from being lifted or creating a different scene when it does get torn away. And that scene, frankly, will be another rich class welfare helping to bail out all the problems, mistakes, and greed that created the downfall and blaming no one other than the abstract market for the problems. What we've seen in the past is that the hot potato of liability the banks thought they had pitched to the investors wants to get tossed back to the banks. It was pointed out by attorney Sean Olander during the whole subprime bubble burst that this tossback was the real reason for the subprime bailout schemes being proposed by the U.S. Treasury Department. Not to keep strapped borrowers in their homes, but to stave off a spate of lawsuits against the banks. One proposal was the creation of a new superfund that would buy risky mortgage bonds, concealing how little those bonds were actually worth. When the plan was abandoned, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson proposed an interest rate freeze on a limited number of subprime loans. And I'll return to this in a moment. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So as I said, when the plan was abandoned, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson proposed an interest rate freeze on a limited number of subprime loans. Olander wrote, quote, The sole goal of the freeze is to prevent owners of mortgage-backed securities, many of them foreigners, from suing U.S. banks and forcing them to buy back worthless mortgage securities at face value, right now almost 10 times their market worth. The ticking time bomb in the U.S. banking system is not resetting subprime mortgage rates. The real problem is the contractual ability of investors in mortgage bonds to require banks to buy back the loans at face value if there was fraud in the origination process. The catastrophic consequences of bond investors forcing originators to buy back loans at face value are beyond the current media discussion. The loans at issue dwarf the capital available at the largest U.S. banks combined, and investor lawsuits would raise stunning liability sufficient to cause even the largest U.S. banks to fail, resulting in massive taxpayer-funded bailouts of Fannie and Freddie and even FDIC. What would be prudent and logical is for the banks that sold this toxic waste to buy it back and for a lot of people to go to prison. If they knew about the fraud, they should have to buy the bonds back, close quote. And of course, once again, because of the manipulative sleights of hand by the Fed and the banking system, the lawsuits did not happen. And even though the fraud was there, almost no one has been liable as the financial diversions continue to amass. As an aside, the thought could send a chill through even the most powerful of investment bankers, including Henry Paulson himself. Olander noted that Paulson headed Goldman Sachs during the heyday of toxic subprime paper writing from 2004 to 2006. Mortgage fraud was not limited to representations made to borrowers or by borrowers or in loan documents. It was in the design of the bank's financial products themselves. One design flaw was that the credit default swaps used to insure against loan default contained no guarantee that the counterparties had the money to pay up. Another flaw was securitized mortgage debt was made so complex that it was very hard to trace who owned the underlying mortgages in a typical mortgage pool, and without a legal signatory to the note or a valid assessment, there was no one with standing to foreclose on the collateral. That was the problem procedurally, prompting Federal District Judge Christopher Boyko to rule in October of 2007 that Deutsche Bank did not have standing to foreclose on 14 mortgage loans held in trust for a pool of mortgage-backed securities. The pool lacked standing because it was nowhere named in the documents conveying title. If large numbers of defaulting homeowners were to contest their foreclosures on the ground that the plaintiff lacked standing to sue, trillions of dollars in mortgage-backed securities could be at risk. Irate security holders might then respond with litigation that could well threaten the existence of the banking Goliaths. A behind-the-scenes bailout would be hard to engineer in those circumstances, since investor lawsuits are not easily hidden behind closed doors. As a footnote, since all of this came up, most judges in most states have sided with the banks, and the standing issue as a bar to the foreclosure has been fairly eroded, and the foreclosures continue. Now, there was a period when the banks were facing legal battles on another front. Disgruntled local officials had started taking them to court. A harbinger of things to come was a first-of-its-kind lawsuit filed in 2008 by Cleveland Mayor Frank Jackson against 21 major investment banks for enabling the subprime lending and foreclosure crisis in his city. City officials said they hope to recover hundreds of millions of dollars in damages from the banks, including lost taxes from devalued property and money spent demolishing and boarding up thousands of abandoned houses. The defendants included banking giants Deutsche Bank, Goldman Sachs, Merrill Lynch, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, and Citigroup. They were charged with creating a public nuisance by irresponsibly buying and selling high-interest home loans, causing widespread defaults that depleted the city's tax base and left neighborhoods in ruins. To me, this is no different from organized crime or drugs, Jackson told the Cleveland newspaper, The Plain Dealer. It has the same effect as drug activity in neighborhoods. It's a form of organized crime that happens to be legal in many respects. He added in a videotaped interview, this lawsuit said, you're not going to do this to us anymore. The Plain Dealer newspaper also interviewed Ohio Attorney General Mark Dan, who was considering a state lawsuit against some of the same banks. There's clearly been a wrong done, he said, and the source is Wall Street. I'm glad to have some company on my hunt. The Cleveland lawsuit followed another the same week in which the city of Baltimore sued Wells Fargo Bank for damages from the subprime debacle. The Baltimore suit alleged that Wells Fargo had intentionally discriminated in selling high-interest mortgages more frequently to blacks than to whites in violation of federal law. But the innovative Cleveland suit took much wider aim, targeting the investment banks that fed off the mortgage market by buying subprime mortgages from lenders and then securitizing them and selling them to investors. On February 1, 2008, the state of Massachusetts filed another sort of lawsuit against a major investment bank. The complaint was for fraud and misrepresentation concerning about $14 million worth of subprime securities sold to the city of Springfield by Merrill Lynch. The complaint focused on the sale of certain esoteric financial instruments known as collateralized debt obligations, which were unsuitable for the city and which, within months after sale, became illiquid and lost most of all of their market value. The suit was further precedent for legal relief for defrauded investors. Once again, these are all hopeful attempts to balance the system, to bring the facts in the open, and to redress the circumstances, helping those who have been hurt and making those who got all of the short-term benefits to pay. But again, in most of these circumstances, the system is so interconnected with the banks that ultimately make the decisions on how the money flows, that the outcomes get watered down and the attention gets diverted to a different spin on the problem. There is an amazing amount of scapegoating throughout the process, but the system itself, the structures that are functionally responsible for the entire mess, continue almost in complete control of the results. Once the paradigm is set up, as it has been with the banks, and the rules are made to function within that setup, then the more fundamental question is never, ever asked. It always becomes an issue of rescuing those that are too big to fail. And we'll continue in the next show. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous, debt-manageable life.